Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, we hear poet Peter Sacks speaking at the University of California, Berkeley. Peter Sacks is considered one of the foremost teachers of poetry in the country. He was born in South Africa in 1950 and discovered poetry while studying at Princeton University. He received his MA from Oxford and his PhD from Yale. He has written 5 books of poetry and, in his 40s, took up the practice of painting. Sacks currently teaches English literature and creative writing at Harvard University. In this lecture, Sacks explores how the image of the dolphin has been used in poetry from the ancient Greeks through modern poets such as Rilke, Yeats, and Elizabeth Bishop. The talk was called "You Only Guide Me by Surprise, Poetry and the Dolphin's Turn." Sacks was speaking in 2007 at the Judith Lee Stronach Memorial Lectures on the Teaching of Poetry, which celebrates the life of arts patron and human rights activist Judith Lee Stronach. Here is Peter Sacks.
Since my main figure will be the dolphin, as associated with poetry itself, let me quote these lines from a poem by Judith Stronach, "The Black Sea." It's one of several of her poems that have a life-changing, delicately yet passionately embodied relation to the natural world. And these are some lines from the poem. Quote, "I sought some offering on the beach. Only an exquisite shell would do. The color of blue faience with a flower growing inside on a piece of driftwood. A twisted mystery suggesting unknown natural forces operative only when the last bather deserts the beach with one perfectly curved branch, a clue to some half-human creature who divides his eternity between dreaming of geometric categories and forging them in these intricate fantasies." So this dreaming, half-human sea creature was clearly an evocative and empowering imaginative figure for this poet. And what fascinates me is how that moment of personal experience intersects with what we'll see this evening has been the case for thousands of years. The twisted, that is to say, tropic mystery, the clue to some half-human, half-eternal sea creature, this is what brings me to the shoreline of my own talk, a shoreline to which I'll add 2 epigraphs. The first is from Robert Lowell. It's from one of his late poems called "The Dolphin." "My dolphin, you only guide me by surprise." So I'm interested by this conjunction of being guided by surprise. And the second is a phrase of William Butler Yeats, not from a poem, but from a letter. And the line is simply, "One dolphin, comma, one man." One dolphin, one man. And that's from a letter that was sent by Yeats to Sturge Moore. Sturge Moore, the wonderful designer, artist, who designed the cover of several of Yeats's books, The Tower, The Winding Stair. Yeats must have already mentioned his idea of wanting to see the dolphin on the cover. That letter is not one that I've managed to find, but I found a very amusing letter in which Sturge Moore wrote back to him and said, quote, "Is your dolphin to be so large that the whole of humanity can ride on its back?" And it's in reply to that that this wonderful phrase, "one dolphin, one man," emerged. And that's a letter that Yeats wrote from Cool Park on Wednesday, October the 8th, 1930. In Byzantium, Yeats is, after all, giving us the traditional figure of the dolphin as a creature who carries the soul, not just the body, towards another, a changed condition. In this poem, it's the condition of the purgatorial fires of the Holy City. He had been reading a book called Apotheosis and the Afterlife. And in this, the author, Strong is the name of the author, describes the dolphin as having been, quote, an emblem of the soul or of its transit. The dead man or his soul may be conveyed to the next life by a dolphin. The dolphin becomes a mystic escort for the dead. By the Renaissance, the dolphin is a fairly widespread emblem. It represents love, diligence, swiftness, but it's also been absorbed into the Christian church and associated with Christ. And we'll get at some of that in a moment, because it's not just the agent of change, it's the great mediator. And behind Christ tonight is going to be the figure of Apollo. So we'll be going back, riding the dolphin, and going into the pre-Christian pagan eras, all the way to the archaic Greek world. And what I shall call the dolphin's turn, a transformative veering from one course to another, a way of being carried off track to a new destination, this turn is one that I want to regard tonight as being paradigmatic for the transport system of poetry itself, both in its formal means and in its thematic actions. Imagine for a moment we are on the coast. It is the year 700 BC. And that we are walking, but let's say sailing, or let's say swimming, or let's say drowning. Suddenly, and that adverb is the adverb for the dolphin, it's also the adverb for vision in poetry. Suddenly, it's a natural adverb for the dolphin, because sudden, the word sudden, derives from underneath, sudden, from the same sub as the word submarine. Suddenly, facing and surfacing as from hidden depths, a creature emerges. And emerging is its characteristic action. That's what the dolphin does, unlike other fish. It emerges over and over, and then it re-enters and re-enters and re-enters. Emerging, as an instance of emergency, its own need for air, its curiosity, its sport, our own surprise, surprise, suddenly, these are all the same prefix. Suddenly, surprisingly, it breaks the surface between two elements. Perhaps as the poem breaks from silence to sound and back, leaping and turning on the sine curve of what differentiates poetry from prose, its high quota of turns of speech and thought, and its distinctive ever-versing, the word verse and the word turning, lineation. Its unique finding of its own frequency. Dolphins, of course, working with echolocation and with sonar. Now, imagine that it leaps not only into your sight, but into the recesses of your mind and into your body, which it does as you take it in, moves through your blood, changes your life in some sense if you are truly open to it. And it swims there inside you. Perhaps the way prior portions of our own brain swim below the surface of the cortex. I mean, I think of this as the way the limbic system or the amygdala operates within the mind at large. So that the dolphin may be a salient figure and a powerful, enduring image because it, in a way, embodies aspects of our own minds. And I think many poems are workings out of the relations between parts of our own minds. So that if you're calling and responding to something out there, you might be calling and responding to something in here that is another part of the brain. And the dolphin, for me, is part of that limbic system of the brain, or the ancient portion of the mammalian mind as it is embodied. So, I want to consider what the literary figure of this creature can, in fact, teach us about the work and the teaching of poetry itself, through whose waters and through whose wave-like turnings The dolphin's inventive and reorienting powers have made themselves felt for more than three millennia. These waters flow from the Homeric hymn to Apollo, 800 to 600 BC, all the way to the poems of Robert Lowell's late volume called The Dolphin, of which I read the first line from the title poem. That was from 1973. Or to Elizabeth Bishop's great vocational portrait, The River Man, which I'll be reading at the end of this evening. And that poem begins, "I got up in the night, for the dolphin spoke to me." Always en route, since it is never still, the dolphin makes its way from the ancient world via Shakespeare and Milton to other 20th century poets, all the way up, that is, to the 20th century, apart from Yeats, Lowell, Bishop, to authors from disparate cultures and predicaments, poets such as Eliot, Rilke, Mandelstam, Celan. And I'll be voyaging between some of these instances in what follows, but I want to begin where I first cite the dolphin as a figure for poetry itself. And this is a poem identifying indelibly the dolphin with the god of poetry itself, the god of the lyre, Apollo. And this is not just any Apollo, okay, because there's many Apollos, Delian Apollo and Telfusian Apollo and all of those Apollos, but the Apollo that we are most familiar with, namely the Apollo of Delphi, the Delphic Apollo. Yes, Delphic. Huh? No. Delphic, from the Greek word for dolphin, Delphus, which is itself associated with the word for the womb, the supposition that the dolphin is womb-shaped, but I believe also the supposition that the dolphin has this regenerative, strangely birth-giving quality. And we keep the term Delphus for the entire family of cetacean mammals, namely Delphinidae. That's what dolphins are. We call them Delphinidae. And I was looking at this arrangement earlier, and I noticed that there are, in fact, some delphiniums in there. They're the somewhat purple ones in the middle. And if you look at them very closely, you'll see that their blossom resembles little dolphins. And they are, in fact, if you look up in the OED, you'll find the word dolphin flower. And that is associated with this family of flowers. And that those two syllables, in other words, Delphi, Delphic, the dolphin, Delphinium, have a way of migrating into many languages, not just many references. They go into Provençal, and into French, into Italian, into German, and even into Russian. You wouldn't expect that. But we'll be looking at a poem of Mandelstam's in which the word for the dolphin is still the Greek word, Delphi, Delphini. And I'm interested in the way in which that word swims like a dolphin through all of these languages, across all of these times, and across all of these cultures. And it may now come as less of a surprise to recall that Yeats's longest dolphin ride, because there are several brief ones elsewhere in the poems, but the longest one carries the whole 12-line middle stanza of the late poem, one of his great poems, I believe, which is, interestingly titled, News for the Delphic Oracle. I'll just read out this little stanza. Straddling each a dolphin's back and steadied by a fin, those innocents relive their death, their wounds open again, the ecstatic waters laugh because their cries are sweet and strange. Through the ancestral patterns dance and the brute dolphins plunge until in some cliff-sheltered bay where wades the choir of love, proffering its sacred laurel crowns, they pitch their burdens off. So, between the Delphic title and the sacred laurel crowns at the end, we know we're on Apollo's turf, or rather in his tides. The Homeric hymn that begins this whole deal performs a ritual mimesis of moving from the tides to the turf, to Apollo's turf. It actually is going to found the oracle. And what it does is it shows you a number of human beings taken off course, having to change the direction of their lives, not just of that particular journey, in order to participate and to make possible the oracular institution of Delphi. Now, lacking the time here to track the entire hymn to Pythian Apollo, I'll simply summarize the opening sections of this poem in order to get to the crucial moment where Apollo chooses his first priest. And you're going to see what form he takes in order to make that calling of these priests. I'm sorry to be summarizing because each detail of this poem is crammed with significance. But the poet, or the chorus, begins by addressing Apollo, acknowledges the gods' dominions, very important to say what belongs to God and what belongs to humans, kind of implicit understanding of what the right measure ought to be for humanity. And after acknowledging his dominions, the poem tells of Apollo's first journey as a newborn god. And remember, he's the son of Zeus and of Leto, and he's born on Earth. And the first journey he makes goes like this. He goes on his way. It's a wonderful phrase. Apollo is like the dolphin. He's always on the move. He goes on his way, the glorious son of Leto, to rocky Pytho. Pytho is the place associated with where the Oracle of Delphi will be founded. Okay, and that's going to be really important to the story. He goes to rocky Pytho, and it's the same word as the python. We'll get to that. Pytho becomes Delphi. He goes there on his way playing on the strings of the hollow lyre, so that going and playing the lyre, lyric, music are twinned, and he's wearing immortal garments fragrant with incense. And his lyre under the golden plectrum gives forth a beautiful sound. This giving forth is something I want to stay with, the idea of issuance, of breaking out and something moving through the air from one place to another. From Pytho, gets there, he goes straight up. So it's one of those changes of direction, not just on the lateral level, but now onto the vertical axis, and he goes straight up, of course, to Olympus. So Delphi is his launching pad, and it becomes the place where, of course, humans can make contact with some other dimension, not just a horizontal plane, but the vertical plane. And he is welcomed into the assembly of the immortals, who greet his music and his radiance with what's called heart-expanding joy and communal song. Now, given such divine celebration, he's aware that the gods are celebrating Apollo. The poet humbly says, well, how am I going to sing any kind of praise to you if you've been praised already by the gods? It's a common predicament at the beginning of poems. How best shall I remember Apollo? And after weighing some discarded options, the poet tracks Apollo's search for a shrine on Earth. Now this, of course, involves the god's necessary re-entry down to Earth, and his careful journey across a wide swath of territories before he first chooses the pleasant spot called Telphusa. And he makes up his architectural plans for a temple and looks like everything's going to be okay, but then he runs into a problem. Somebody already has the spot. Very, very illuminating for much that is to come in civilization at large. And Telphusa is a female presence who says, I don't think this is such a good idea. There's a lot of people come by here, it's kind of noisy, and you might want to find another place a little further away. So he hikes on and finds this remote mountain cleft, which is, of course, going to be the womb-shaped place, Delphi, also called Pytho for a while. And as he goes, remember that we as readers are following him. So we're making the journey too. And he finds Pytho, which is right under the peaks of Parnassus. Anybody who's been to Delphi knows that extraordinary situation of that place. And here he lays the actual stone foundations of his first temple, which you can still visit and walk around today. He soon has a particular task, which is to vanquish the dragon called Typho, who lives there and who is declared a menace. Seems to be the way people tend to occupy territories. They say, oh, there's somebody there who's a real menace, and we have to go there and deal with it. But there's good power and bad power, and we're going to be on the side of Apollo tonight, okay? He does vanquish the dragon, Pitho, and lets the carcass rot in the sun. The word Pitho means to rot in Greek. And he will incorporate the powers of that strangely chthonic creature, this dragon, and we'll see how those powers begin to inform the power of the dolphin. And the place becomes called Pitho after he's conquered the python, which is also what we do. We tend to name places very often, states or cities, for the people who used to live there who we kicked out. Or we name streets after the creatures that used to live there. And he now has the task. Okay, so who's going to serve me? Here's what the poem says, and I'm using the translation by Thelma Sargent. He considered well in his heart which of mankind he should bring in to serve him as priests in his sacred temple precinct in rocky Pitho. While turning his thoughts about in his mind, and I love this even in the Greek, turning thoughts around in the mind, it's what poetry does, it's one of these forms of turning. He espied out on the wine-dark sea, you can hear Homer, a swift ship, and within it men many and noble, Cretans from Minoan Cnossus, civilization preceding that of Athens, those who now offer sacrifice to the Lord and proclaim the decrees of gold-bladed Phoebus Apollo, however he may respond in oracular utterance out of the laurel leaves up in the hollow under Parnassus. They in the black ship, and this is crucial, were bent on business and matters of trade. And they were sailing to sandy Pylos and to the men born in Pylos. In other words, they had secular material interests. They were out for profit. They were making this horizontal journey along one course. That was the course of who they were, merchant seamen. What happens is that that journey gets intercepted. When Phoebus Apollo came forth to meet them, rushing upon the swift ship in the sea in the shape of a dolphin. And he lay on the deck, a great monster and frightful to see. Now this moving very fast, the velocity of the intervening, intercepting, semi-divine creature is crucial all through the poems we'll be looking at tonight. And why, though, should this god take the form of a dolphin? Why not just show up and say, I'm the god, and this way? Well, my sense is that there was a predisposition in the ancient mind, as Rilke will later surmise in his poem, Delphine. There was a predisposition to see and to revere the dolphin as a quasi-divine and prodigious, perhaps, creature. Perhaps there'd already been incidents of dolphins saving or carrying the bodies of humans, as in the legends of Orion, Amphion, Orion, as well as Arion. Perhaps the intelligent gregariousness of this mammal and its weird part fish, part animal, part marine, part aerial, now submerged, now flashing out, perhaps it had elicited the human faculty of surprised wonder and gratitude. At least in this poet's mind, if not yet in the minds of these particular merchants. Perhaps they'd even observed the way dolphins are amongst the very few creatures in the natural world to actually save each other. You know that a dolphin has to breathe every 30 seconds, approximately. Now, if a dolphin gets sick, it sinks. And in schools of dolphins, it's been noticed that a dolphin gets, one of the school gets appointed to be the nurse of that sick dolphin. And it nurses that dolphin by propping it up and bringing it up to the surface so that it can continue to breathe until it can recover. And this, I believe, must have been seen, since people observed the natural world for generations there and they lived in the sea, this Greek culture. Probably that, and perhaps some encounters with the human, gave rise to the salvific as well as wondrous nature of this creature. Now, what Apollo has done is he's entered the form of a dolphin, but he has gone and landed himself onto the boat and refused to move. And this is what happens. None of the Cretans pondered the happening so as to know, but desired only to cast off the dolphin, who shook the black ship every which way, causing the very timbers to tremble. The ship has been the craft, it's the technology of human beings, but it has been suddenly dispossessed and taken possession of by this other creature. So everything that humans can make is now qualified by what this creature can do. And this sensation, this domination, this trembling, literal trembling, as the Greek says, is one of the great constants for any heightened aesthetic, passional, or religious experience, fear and trembling, we have the phrase. Also, of course, the string of the lyre trembles, or the reed of any wind instrument trembles. So that there is something about this trembling that I think is worth our thinking about together. The ship or craft trembles, the adherent witness trembles. They're in the presence of a force that seems to have a vibrating power. This trembling, you'll hear it in other contexts when people are on the brink of encountering vision as from elsewhere. Remember Hardy, when he's in the presence of the darkling thrush, says they trembled through his happy goodnight air, some blessed hope of which he knew and I was unaware. In other words, what is this trembling there? And we can find many other instances of this. For the moment, they sit there, the ship trembles, and they sat in the hollow black ship, silent and fearful. So you've got fear and trembling. Nor did they loosen the tackle or let down the sail of the dark, proud vessel, but held to the course they had set. So they try to keep going in the way they had intended. They're not yet ready to understand what has happened to them. But the well-built ship responded not to the rudder. And with the aid of the wind, which is of course sent by the divine agencies of its father Zeus, Lord Apollo, who works from afar, easily guided it straight on its way. So this ship has been indeed hijacked. I think this is one of the earliest hijacking scenes of all literature, and it's going to be a theme worth sticking to as you go through most of literature. I believe that every poem is a miniature hijacking experience. It takes you off course, and the question is, are you open to making that journey? So, they move around the coast, and they come to the shoreline just below Delphi, a place called Creta. You can still swim there. It's very evident where the port is. And as if signaling his affinity with the sun here, Apollo turns back from a dolphin into yet another kind of creature, a comet, a meteoric stellar form that goes bursting out through the sky and goes way up to the top of the mountain. And this is the way the Greek says it, or at least this translation. Then out of the ship, like a star at midday, shot Lord Apollo, who works from afar, and sparks in profusion flashed from him, and the blaze reached to heaven. So this other change of direction now, back onto the vertical axis of the poem, and it's very like his first ascent to Olympus. Then he entered his shrine, sinking from sight between precious tripods, and there kindled a flame that flared up and showed forth his arrows. Then, bounding forth from his shrine, notice this to and fro, up and down, back and forth, work of poetry, he flew swiftly as thought back once more to the ship, seeming this time a vigorous man and strong, in the flower of his youth, and his long hair lay along his broad shoulders, and he spoke to the Cretans, addressing them with winged words. Now, this is the first time that God has spoken to actual men, the poem having begun with an attempt to speak from men to God. Presumably, what has to have happened is that the sailors have had to come under the physical spell of this creature before they can enter into an interpretive ability to understand what it's saying. So, he says, in the form of questions, O strangers, who are you? From what land do you sail over the watery ways of the sea? Are you merchants? Or do you rove aimlessly over the waves like pirates who wander about risking their own lives and bringing evil to others? So Apollo has this wonderful way of x-raying straight through to the various pursuits of profit, either trade or piracy. And he tells them to get off the ship and to eat a meal, and he encourages them. And the captain says, Stranger, yet you are like no one of mortal kind in conformation or stature, but like the immortal gods. What place is this? What country? What people live here? With a different journey in mind, we were sailing on the great sea, bound for Pylos from Crete, the land we claim as our birthplace. Now we have come with our ship to this place all unwilling. Another way, other path, and we long to return to our home. But one of the immortal gods led us hither against our will. So much later literature is embodied in this moment of disorientation. Where are we? Who are you? What is going on here? Why is it that we have to take another way? Another way, other paths. It's not unlike Dante hearing from Virgil, a te convien tener altro viaggio. To you, it's beholden that you have to take another way. You can't just go straight up that hill. And remember, what had blocked Dante? A series of animals. So I'm really fascinated by this encounter of the human with the creature world, then having to make a turn to a different kind of journey. So the sailors have been taken off course to Pythos, and it's more than a geographical turn. It's one which involves painfully, fearfully, silencingly encountering the limits of the human will and of technology, and of realigning that will with a greater source of volition, a source that will now turn or convert their very identities and vocations from those of merchant seamen to those of priests. First, though, there is the actual apocalyptic unveiling, the revelation regarding the true identity of their hijacker. And he says, in answer to who are you, I am the son of Zeus. Verily, I am Apollo. And I led you here, over the boundless deep of the sea, not intending you harm, but that here you should keep my rich temple and by all men be held in high honor. You shall know the decrees of the gods, and by their will, always through all time to come, be deeply revered. And he orders them to build an actual altar on the shore to sacrifice grains of white barley, and then to make the journey with him uphill to the actual shrine in the mountains. This is what he says. As I first appeared to you in the form of a dolphin, rushing upon the swift ship in the turbulent sea, so pray to me as Delphinian, and the altar itself shall be called Delphinian, overlooking everything, forever. And in the Greek, you see this wonderful playing of that word, Delphi, Delphoi, Delphinii, as if the word is moving through the mouth and through the mind of the poet, migrating into this, and it goes from small d to big D. And it's a remarkable piece of myth-making happening just within three lines there. As I was like a dolphin, so pray to me as Delphinian. The altar is now Delphi. So they make the final climb, and they get to the actual temple. And the way they are described as they are climbing there is almost identical to the way in which Apollo was described when he first went up to Olympus as a young god. And this time, of course, though, he's in the company of mortals. As it says, they set out with the son of Zeus, Lord Apollo, who led them, holding a lyre in his hands and playing beautiful music and stepping high and nimbly before them. And the Cretans, stamping the earth in the dance, followed after. To Pytho they went, hymning the paean like the chanters of Crete and those in whose hearts the heavenly muse has instilled honeyed song. So there you get the relation between priests and poets Anybody who has received inspiration, this encounter with the dolphin is now like not just a divine calling, but the experience of receiving honeyed song. Unwearied on foot, they ascended the ridge and soon reached Parnassus and the lovely spot where they were destined to dwell, honored by men without number, and Apollo, leading them, showed them his most holy innermost shrine and the rich temple. Now, there's some final negotiations required because they look around, they say, this is not a very agriculturally promising place. How are we going to live? And he says, don't worry. People are going to show up here with serious offerings, and it's going to be okay. And he says, guard it well in your heart. And now comes the crucial parting instruction. Know the difference between hubris and themis. Themis, T-H-E-M-I-S. We're familiar with hubris. In other words, know the difference between overweening arrogance on the one hand and customary right action, which is themis. Themis, capital T-H-E-M-I-S, was in fact a goddess of law and justice who had fed the newborn Apollo. So he'd been raised on Themis. And instructing them on the difference between hubris and Themis, say the difference between the present White House and a decent law-abiding institution. This is his final instruction. Not to be aggressive, brutal, deceitful, greedy, lying, out for gain at the cost of war or torture or abuse, but seeking indeed to keep peace. These are his instructions, and with that, he leaves. Now that's just a brief overview of this work that this hymn is doing. And rather than make more close analyses of that hymn, I'm going to jump forward carrying its lines of force and look at a few later examples. We're all familiar with Rilke's great poem, The Archaic Torso of Apollo. Almost over-familiar poem. But once you've got the association of Apollo and this Pythian Apollo, an almost Delphic creature, I think this poem comes to yet another level of intensity. And it's the early 20th century. Apollo lives now where? Not in the natural elements, not in institutional structures of belief, but in the corridors of the museum, of the Musée Imaginaire, literally in the Louvre, through which we may imagine the young Rilke, working at this time for Rodin, looking at Cézanne, making his way and suddenly encountering this extraordinary torso, encountering, in the way that those sailors encountered Apollo, a magnificent, compelling creature which seems to regard him as with a reorientingly total, wild, and radiating gaze, making us, him, aware of our own more than merely cerebral bodies, and culminating in the edict, which is the edict of Apollo to those Cretan sailors, basically, you must change your life. So how is this a constant in the work of Apollo? Now, if we look a little closer at the final line, you must change your life, especially if we refer to the German, we'll refine our understanding of this command. Because English finds it hard to end a sentence with a verb. Okay, you don't say, you must your life change. But German ends it with that word change, ändern. And that final word, which is going to echo now into the silence of the as yet unformed, it's into that space, into that silence that the changed life will travel. But that word ändern rhymes with the word rändern. And what he's saying there is, aus allen seinem rändern, aus wie ein Stern, like a star, which is the image that was used for the moment in which Apollo burst from the boat like a star and broke his way up into the vertical. In other words, the change is like the breaking, aus allen seinen Rändern, aus wie ein Stern. You have to change the way you might burst from all the contours of yourself. It's a outline redefining change. You break the borders, you break the contours. Now, while you're looking at the German, you'll see that I've underlined a few words. Glanzt, meaning to shine, and the word Bug, which is here a surge or a swell or a rondure, as of the breath, and then the word Stern. Now, those three words show up in a poem that is just a couple of poems away, written probably in the same weeks, and it is the poem called Dolphins, or Delfine. So these are very closely twinned indeed. It's not just my imagining. And I'm simply going to read the poem Dolphins. Again, this is Edward Snow's translation, just to give you a sense of this perhaps overlooked poem, which I find to be extremely suggestive and beautiful. And he says, those real ones, jene wirklichen, by which he means those archaic Greeks who were able to perceive both the real world and the mythological world at the same time. Those real ones who gave their equal the power to grow and to take hold everywhere, felt through kindred signs equivalences in the fluid realm which the god with drenching tritons inundated sometimes surmounts. For there the animal had shown itself different from the mute, phlegmatic stock of fishes, alive with their human blood and drawn to the human from afar. From afar is the Greek characteristic of Apollo. It works from afar. A band of them came up, somersaulting, gay, as though they felt the waters sparkling, warm, deep-feeling beings, whose convoy, wreathing the voyage as if with confidence, lightly joined around the curving bow, boog, as if circling a vase's midriff, blissful, carefree, secure from being wounded, this is the ancient world, not now, secure from being wounded, catapulted up, swept away, surging, and in dives, exchanging with the waves, bore the trireme brightly after it. And the sailor took this newly given friend into his lonely peril and gratefully devised for it, for the companion there, a world, and knew beyond all doubt that it too loved music, gods, gardens, and the deep, silent, stellar year. Now, I won't pause for comment there. The poem speaks so completely for itself, and it returns us to that wonderful silence, the deep, silent, interstellar year, which it, as a poem, has served to deepen, even as it has mediated human, animal, divine, ocean, earth, and heaven, language, music, silence. And rather than spending more time on that poem, I want to juxtapose it, I'm going to start moving a little faster now, with another poem that comes from the very next year, because I'm trying to track the universality of this image. And this is a poem by the very young Russian poet Mandelstam, writing in 1909, the very year after Rilke's poem. And it's a brief poem. Mandelstam is only, he's born in 91, so he's only 18. And you'll see this poem, the dolphin becomes a literal vehicle, okay, a literal vehicle for the metaphoric tenor of the soul, a being that swims the soul way beyond or beneath language or pedagogy, into the furthest reaches either of consciousness or of the world as we perceive it. And this is the translation, there is no need for speech and nothing to teach. How sad yet beautiful is the dark, brutal soul. It has nothing it wants to teach and lacks even the power of speech. But like a young dolphin swims where the world's gray deeps are dim. It's odd that that Yeatsian brute is in there along with the soul. What the dolphin is doing is it's making its counter-assertive powers felt below the level of the human will, turning, carrying us to other shores or deeps. It is breaking without temporal and spatial bounds. It's reorienting us, and it's taking us into the dim reaches of the soul. Now, this subversive turn, the kind of stubborn withdrawal to other ungovernable domains, this within a couple of decades would mark the tragic course of Mandelstam's own vocational opposition to the Stalinist regime. He's saying, has nothing to speak, nothing to say, nothing to teach. This thing is another kind of life that interests me. And the heartbreakingly mature poem that Mandelstam will write in just 20 years, to which I would like to turn quickly next, was written from exile in Voronezh in March of 1937, a year before his death in the Gulag. And it's written from the Russian hinterland, where he was not yet in the Gulag, he was in exile, and apparently there was a small museum there with bits of old Greek pottery. And he came upon some of this Greek pottery and was inspired to write this poem, which implicitly rejects the spatio-temporal hegemony of Stalin's Soviet state in order to praise the ancient Mediterranean island from which, after all, Apollo's priests had originated, namely Crete. And we might recall in the dolphin poem of Rilke, the figures of the dolphin circling a vase's midriff, as we're drawn into Mandelstam's far more intense hymn-like plea to the sacred pagan world, to a world of generative, transformative making, to which this desolate, broken, work-deprived, prematurely aged 45-year-old genius prayed for a renewed access to the unpossessable, because more than merely personal sphere of his own being. Just for its potters, the dark blue island Crete, the light-hearted is great. When the earth they baked rings, you can hear their genius. Do you hear fins of dolphins beating deep in the earth? Speak of this sea, and it will rise in the clay to smile in its oven, and the frigid power of the vessel become half sea, half eye. Blue Island, give me back what is mine. Flying Crete, give back my work to me. Fill the baked vessel from the breasts of the flowing goddess. This was and was sung and turned blue in days before Odysseus, before food and drink were called mine. Grow strong again and shine, O star of ox-eyed heaven, and you, flying fish of chance, and you, O water, saying yes. So in the teeth of terminal deprivation and oppression, in a state of utter terror, Mandelstam makes what I am calling the dolphin turn, to an almost superhuman affirmation, one that carries him well beyond any gulag or nation state into the trans-historical and transnational current surging from element to creature, from god to human initiate, from ancient Delphinian vessel to the revived outpouring of radiant poetic words. I'm going to skip all the way past the poem of Ceylon, and I'm going to simply end by reading the poem at the very back. The Ceylon poem is a remarkable poem. I do urge you to read it in the context. He has the word Tummler in there, which is another German word for porpoise or for dolphin. Yes, there is a German word Delfina, but if you look up Tummler, it also means dolphin. And, oh, I'll just read it since it's very brief in English. What's written, and you hear the echo with Mandelstam. Ceylon revered Mandelstam. He was like a brother to Ceylon. He translated Mandelstam's poems. He responded to Mandelstam's poems in his own work. Here, it's like the first poem of Mandelstam about the dolphin as opposed to kinds of language. What's written goes hollow. What's spoken, sea green, burns in the bay. dolphins race through liquefied names. Here in forever nowhere, in a memory of outcrying bells, in but where? Who in this shadow quadrant is gasping? Who underneath glimmers up, glimmers up, glimmers up? Schimmert auf, schimmert auf, schimmert auf. The auf is like the Bracha aus of the Rilke archaic torso poem, but it's that outgiving that I'm interested in all the way from the Homeric hymn. Now, I mentioned Yeats at the beginning, I mentioned Byzantium, I mentioned News for the Delphic Oracle. You might want to know that the poem that precedes these, namely Sailing to Byzantium, which has no mention of dolphins in it, has in its first draft the following sequence of lines. Remember, the aged, tattered coat upon a stick, figure of Yeats wondering where does the soul go, if anywhere, conjures up this sacred city of Byzantium, these amazing mosaics, like the mosaics there that we saw at the beginning, and asks them to summon him forth. He says, O saints that stand amid God's sacred fire and in the gold mosaic of a wall, transfigure me. But now, in the early draft, he says, oh, it's amazing that this is behind Sailing to Byzantium. Oh, send the dolphins back and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Okay, so rather than read Lowell's poem, The Dolphin, I'm going to end with simply reading this great poem of Elizabeth Bishop's, The River Man, and I'm happy to do so because it is a poem of reentry. It is a poem of being called to a shamanic vocation, of having to listen to what the dolphin wishes you to do. And it's written by Elizabeth Bishop, who lived for many years in Brazil, but it's written out of a source, as you see in the epigraph, called Amazon Town, which I've read, by Charles Wagley. What's fascinating is that Jung, Levi-Strauss, whatever you need, you have to know that those people living in those rainforests had probably not read the Homeric hymn to Apollo. And yet, the figure of the dolphin, since there are freshwater dolphins, there's less and less every minute, but the dolphin has a similar role to play. And this is Elizabeth Bishop, not usually a mythological poet, but through the voice of this shaman, giving, I think, one of the most eloquent versions of this entire mythos. And I'm just going to read it. It'll take about 6 minutes and then stop. I got up in the night, for the dolphin spoke to me. He grunted beneath my window, hid by the river mist, but I glimpsed him. A man like myself. I threw off my blanket, sweating. I even tore off my shirt. I got out of my hammock and went through the window naked. My wife slept and snored. Hearing the dolphin ahead, I went down to the river, and the moon was burning bright as the gasoline lamp mantle when the flame turned up too high, just before it begins to scorch. I went down to the river. I heard the dolphin sigh as he slid into the water. I stood there listening till he called from far outstream. I waded into the river, and suddenly a door in the water opened inward, groaning a little, with water bulging above the lintel. I looked back at my house, white as a piece of washing, forgotten on the bank, and I thought once of my wife, that I knew what I was doing. They gave me a shell of cachaça, great cane spirit, very strong, and decorated cigars. The smoke rose like mist through the water, and our breaths didn't make any bubbles. We drank cachaça and smoked the green cheroots. The room filled with gray-green smoke, and my head couldn't have been dizzier. Then a tall, beautiful serpent in elegant white satin, with her big eyes green and gold, like the lights of the river steamers. Yes, Luandinha, none other, entered and greeted me. She complimented me in a language I didn't know. But when she blew cigar smoke into my ears and nostrils, I understood like a dog, although I can't speak it yet. They showed me room after room and took me from here to Belém and back again in a minute. In fact, I'm not sure where I went, but miles under the river. 3 times now I've been there. I don't eat fish anymore. There is fine mud on my scalp, and I know from smelling my comb that the river smells in my hair. My hands and feet are cold. I look yellow, my wife says, and she brews me stinking teas I throw out behind her back. Every moonlit night, I'm to go back again. I know some things already, but it will take years of study. It is all so difficult. They gave me a muffled rattle and a pale green coral twig and some special weeds like smoke there under my canoe. When the moon shines on the river, oh, faster than you can think it, we travel upstream and downstream. We journey from here to there, under the floating canoes, right through the wicker traps. When the moon shines on the river and Luandinha gives a party, 3 times now I've attended. Her rooms shine like silver with the light from overhead, a steady stream of light, like at the cinema. I need a virgin mirror no one's ever looked at, that's never looked back at anyone, to flash up the spirit's eyes and help me recognize them. The storekeeper offered me a box of little mirrors, but each time I picked one up, a neighbor looked over my shoulder, and then that one was spoiled. Spoiled, that is, for anything but the girls to look at their mouths in, to examine their teeth and smiles. So it's the mirror not of narcissism, not of actual self-reflection, but of speculative imagining of another spirit. Why shouldn't I be ambitious? It's great lines for a poet. I sincerely desire to be a serious sakaka, the shaman, like Fortunato Pombo, or Lucio, or even the great Joachim Sakaka. This would be like Keats saying, I'd sincerely like to be like Milton, or Shakespeare, or etc. Look, and here the ecological consciousness of this poem starts brimming like the river itself, and I'm very happy to be reading these lines in the presence of Bob Haas. Look, it stands to reason that everything we need can be obtained from the river. It drains the jungles. It draws from trees and plants and rocks from half around the world. It draws from the very heart of the earth the remedy for each of the diseases. One just has to know how to find it. But everything must be there in that magic mud beneath the multitudes of fish, deadly or innocent, the giant pirarucus, the turtles and crocodiles, tree trunks and sunk canoes, with the crayfish, with the worms, with tiny electric eyes turning on and off and on. The river breathes in silt, breathes in salt, and breathes it out again. And all is sweetness there, in the deep, enchanted silt. When the moon burns white, and the river makes that sound like a primus pumped up high, that fast high whispering like 100 people at once, I'll be there below. As the turtle rattle hisses and the coral gives the sign, traveling fast as a wish with my magic cloak of fish, swerving as I swerve, following the veins, the river's long, long veins to find the pure elixirs. Godfathers and cousins, your canoes are over my head. I hear your voices talking. You can peer down and down or dredge the river bottom, but never, never catch me. When the moon shines and the river lies across the earth and sucks it like a child, then I will go to work to get you health and money. The dolphin singled me out. Luandinha seconded it. Thank you.
That was Peter Sacks speaking at the University of California, Berkeley in 2007 as part of the Judith Lee Stronach Memorial Lectures on the Teaching of Poetry. The recording was kindly provided by the Bancroft Library and is used with permission of the University of California, Berkeley. Another lecture by Peter Sacks is available from the Poetry Lectures podcast series. In it, Sacks discusses the paintings of Edward Hopper and the poetry of Robert Frost, Elizabeth Bishop, and T.S. Eliot. Peter Sacks has published 5 collections of poetry and a book of criticism, The English Elegy, Studies in the Genre from Spenser to Yeats. You can read more about Peter Sacks and some of his poems at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find many other articles about poets and poetry, an online archive of more than 9,000 poems, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.